bigger shows, Paris, Dubai, you name it, you will go round and you'll come back buzzing with so many ideas and so many people you've seen.
You've got to have something which drags the reader in. You've also got that stand first or the slug at the front as well, which really needs to grab somebody. And as Tim said, you've got your opening paragraph, which sets the scene for what you're doing, and you need a good summary at the end.
It's one of the best things I've ever done in my life. No lies. It was incredible, and I still struggle now to put words around it, really.
Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. And welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and thank you for joining us today. Today we've got our second roundtable discussion. This time we're focusing on aviation journalism and what makes a good aviation article or publication. So I'm going to ask our guests to introduce themselves today. So Tim, Rich and Steve. Tim, let me come to you first. Tim, your journalistic CV.
All right, okay. So my journalistic CV, I'm Tim Robinson. I'm editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine. You know me as a regular fixture on Extended. 22 years at the Royal Aeronautical Society working on Aerospace Magazine, 12 years as editor-in-chief, quoted in BBC, CNN, iMechE, Popular Mechanics, newspapers, and won the Aerospace Media Awards, an award at the Aerospace Media Awards in 2021 and 2019. That's me.
Steve.
Okay, I'm Steve Bridgewater. I work with Tim now at the Aeronautical Society. I'm deputy editor on Aerospace Magazine, but I started editing aeroplane magazines back in the year 2000. Started off with a magazine called Air Action, which was aimed at getting kids involved in aviation as either a hobby or a career. Moved into the general aviation field, worked on Today's Pilot as deputy editor, and then moved across to Pilot Magazine, launching Go Flying for them. Took a bit of a career break to go and do a couple of aeroplane museum things, and then returned to the industry to edit a magazine called Jets Monthly. Spent a brief period at Aeroplane Monthly. And I've done various freelance work as well for magazines as diverse as Dog Friendly. And most recently, a magazine called Aircraft Cabin Management. So joined the Aeronautical Society in May and loving every minute of it so far.
Excellent. Excellent. And Rich.
Wow, I've got to follow those two, have I? That's quite tricky. Very illustrious career. So I'm Rich Cooper. I currently run the Centre of Aviation Photography, and I'm one of the few full-time aviation photographers in the world. I started way back, literally like when I was 7 years old. I had my first picture published when I was 11. And obviously going with that comes caption writing. So I was very quickly into putting words together with my images to tell the story. And that developed into something of a freelance kind of contribution career in my early teens. That was very fortunate to turn into a full-time job for over a decade at Combat Aircraft Magazine and Aircraft Illustrated, where I was editor of Combat Aircraft and deputy editor of Aircraft Illustrated until 2008. And then I went freelance again and continued to develop my aviation photography. And, set up Co-op in 2015 and continue to do the freelance aviation photography, for magazines around the world, as well as run Co-op.
Wow. Okay, guys, listen, great lineup. This came about because I was with Tim at Farnborough a few years ago, and he kindly brought me into the team covering the show, and he gave me an insight into, some of the work that you have to do to get an article published to make it readable, to make it understandable, to fact check it, and of course, to make it visually appealing as well. So, Tim, let me come to you first then, seeing as this is where it started. How do you go about researching a story that you're given? Where does it come from? Where do these ideas come from for a story? Is it the news that drives them? Is it, how's that all work?
Ooh, blimey, right. It's all off Twitter these days. we just take all people's tweets. No, how's a story feature researched? Well, you know, sometimes it's just talking to the right person. Sometimes it's a press visit. Sometimes, you know, I mean, Farnborough, you said about Farnborough. I mean, the great thing about Farnborough, the big air shows, Paris, Dubai, you name it, you will go round and you'll come back buzzing with so many ideas and so many people you've seen and so many exciting things you've seen. It's like, right, okay, I really need to chase that up. Occasionally you can get people come to you and say, oh, I've got a really interesting, do you know this, or I can give you a tip here, or don't tell anybody else, but off the record, blah 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 blah. That's sort of sets you off, and then really it's kind of going out there, you know, the old way, I suppose, would be going into a library. Remember those things? And looking at back issues of your own magazine, looking at you know, other magazines, what are they written about it, and then going out and really kind of you know, kind of finding other material on the subject, you know, hunting down reports, hunting down books maybe, and then also chasing up contacts. So it's really kind of going there and going, right, who else do I know that knows about this subject that can maybe give the alternate view or can give an independent view or, you know, can comment on it expertly. You know, am I being led up the garden path here by the person of the thing here? Am I on the right track? You know, do I have a sort of sense check? So it's really those sort of things that are, you know, kind of come together. You know, once you've got there and you've got a, you know, the bulk of it, I start sort of writing down. And then a lot of the time, really, if you've got a really good story and you've got plenty to say, and Steve will agree, will probably nod in his head with agreement here, it's actually cutting it back. A lot of it is, you know, you get lots and lots of stuff.
So,
you know,
true.
How
do I get it? So really then it's almost kind of whittling it away. What's the core of this? What's the most interesting bit? What are my readers going to be most interested in? And really shaving it all back right down to the basics to get to the core of it. So, you know, whatever story you're writing about, whether it's an air show or news, bam, you write down to the real sort of, you know, in as short and as clear possible, you know, way as you know, within your word deadline, you know, word count deadline as possible to get it all in. Yeah, I don't know.
Let me come to Steve then, because one of the things we've talked about in the past, Steve, is your flying experience. This is a highly technical environment where everybody's an expert out there. How do you get those technical details right, particularly some of the things that we see in terms of things like flying techniques, flying characteristics, and those sorts of things? How do you balance off what do I know, what do I feel, what have I done versus, I suppose, yeah, the real world?
I think it's a very fine line. You need to explain things to the reader, but you also don't want to teach them to suck eggs, as it were. Yeah, you have to assume a certain level of knowledge in the reader. And you also have to be, you know, as Tim and Rich will agree, yeah, we're very lucky to do what we do. And it's very easy to absolutely. Yeah, it's very easy to come across in an article and almost make people very envious. We don't want to do that. It's not the case of look at us and the wonderful opportunities that we've got. It's about sharing those experiences with people. But you have to assume that if somebody is reading a magazine, a private flying magazine, that they are a private pilot or they are learning to fly or they have some sort of interest. So from that point of view, I think the level of detail that you've put in is actually very important. They want to know the cruise speed of the aeroplane. They want to know, you know, how long, you know. I used to do a series when I was at Today's Pilot called Owning and Operating. And rather than actually writing about what the aeroplane was like to fly, we wrote about what it was like to own it. So could you get spare tires for it? Could, you know, how much oil did it burn? What's the insurance cost like? Things like that that people want to know. And we found that was a very popular feature because you know, it's all well and good going and flying the latest whiz-bang £500,000 worth of light aircraft. But the majority of the breeders are never going to do that. However, they might be in a situation where they can perhaps buy a quarter share in a Piper PA-28 or a Cessna 152 or something like that. So, yeah, I think that's the important thing. It's just, it's not patronising, but putting a lot of information in that's of interest.
Rich, I mentioned they're making articles visually appealing, and in the culture that we live in today with social media, with snappy short lines and everything has to be really attractive and eye candy and all those things. What sort of challenges do you then face before you go out on a photo shoot in particular to try and think about how am I going to make this right for this audience, for this publication, for this platform?
I think, well, Stephen touched on a little bit as well. You've got to know your audience. You've got to really know the market you're giving the photographs to. There's no point, you know, sort of like photographing it from a very technical point of view if the magazine is very creative, for example. So you have perhaps an idea in your mind about what needs to be shown. Very often I find myself, not being with the crowd as such, and obviously, like, you know, There's certain angles at a shoot which are, you know, imperative, like say the keynote speaker in front of the aeroplane. Okay, that's really important. But, you know, just because that's where the press pack is doesn't necessarily mean that's where the best shot is going to be. So I very much look for different angles and to tell kind of like the story of what we're actually seeing in front of us. If it's an unveiling or something like that, or a press conference, you know, what else is happening? What message is the company trying to portray as well? And getting the flavour of that company and the product, for example, you know, kind of like with a Farnborough head on, over into the magazine or the internet site or whoever it is I'm working for at the time. And that's not easy because obviously magazines and internet sites obviously have their own, styles as well. Everyone needs everything yesterday. You know, so, you know, sort of the days of kind of, going for a long shoot and going back and editing the shots and sending them to a magazine they're almost pretty much over. You know, so again, using Farnborough as a great example, having, you know, a big show that we've all worked on very recently. You know, my iPhone was an absolute godsend, you know, because I could take the shots, I could record some interviews, I could immediately WhatsApp it to my boss that was there at the time, and it's on their social media within seconds, you know. And yeah, of course you can do that with DSLRs, you know, you can Wi-Fi it across, and you get Wi-Fi even built into your cards nowadays and stuff. So, you know, there's technology out there, but DSLRs are quite big, heavy stuff to be dragging around, and the files are big and everything else, which is great for a reason. But yeah, just if in terms of a press conference inside a really poorly lit hangar or you know, exhibition site, an iPhone does it brilliantly. So you'll hear me sing that praise quite a lot this evening, I expect.
I've stopped carrying a small camera with me. I carry my big camera and a big lens, whereas I used to have two bodies, one with a short lens for static and one with a big lens for the flying. I just carry the big camera now, and the iPhone's a static. That's all I really need.
I want to come back to tools of the trade in a moment, but something you said there, Rich, was really interesting, because you do have quite a unique style. You use teasers, and again, I want to come back to that in a bit. But that uniqueness, how do you make that, how do you bring that through in the words? You know, something we try and do on Extended is we try and have, you know, last week's episode was the Stalingrad airlift. Today we're talking about aviation journalism. We want to take a different angle, a slightly different approach, give listeners something different. How do you do that without it being visual? How does the wordsmithing that we use? How do you do that?
Well, the wires are obviously super powerful because that's what we use to describe stuff, right? So, you know, a photograph can tell so much, and we've all heard the phrase, you know, an image is worth 1,000 words and stuff. But, yeah, it might be the other way around, you know. It's, words are so powerful in terms of what's written, and especially if there's a mistake in the words, as we were talking about earlier, how important it is to get it right. You know,
if
I'm reading something and there's a mistake in it, I'm immediately put off from the image and the story, perhaps even, you know. So I very, very rarely actually read books because I'm sitting there editing them as I'm reading them. It's a really annoying trait. So, but I do recommend reading, because that broadens your vocabulary and everything else and your ability to write in different styles. But I think a lot of it for me personally, and this might not be the case for everyone, but it's certainly for me personally, is having an affiliation and a passion for the subject. Because I think if you've got that, then your personality comes out with it. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily know too much about, say, the current modern VIP helicopter industry, for example. I could write something about it, but it would be fairly dry. But I could certainly talk about the experience of being there and what it was like to walk into this plush VIP hangar and, you know, meet the chief executive and what their goals are. You know, they're all kind of like copy and paste features of any kind of thing you go and cover, right? But I think having a passion for the subject really helps. I don't think I could write about dishwashers very well, for example. That sort of thing. But give me an aeroplane and a subject, then kind of there's lots of similarities, like I said, with going into a VIP helicopter operation and or going into a Spitfire restoration shop at a museum, but there's going to be people there to talk to. They've got a story to tell. And, you know, by getting involved in it and actually talking to the people and getting enthused for it and using your imagination as to how that story can be portrayed is key to it, really. But it, as Tim said, oh my goodness, then the challenge comes of cutting that down because you just get too enthusiastic, right?
Yeah. And Tim, let me come to you then, because recently we've talked about equipment for a particular interview that you were working on. What's a journalist's equipment list look like these days?
Smartphone. well, you know, smartphone, notepad, obviously pen, you know, keep that with you. I take a recorder around as well, just in case, because I'm super paranoid that, you've got your phone out, you know, that'll be the time when you realize it's out of charge because the charger wasn't working in the hotel last night. And so you've got to whip that out. And, but what, one of the things that has been useful recently is Otter AI. So that is automatic transcribing software that uploads it, you know, records it and uploads it. And you get a transcription, sort of almost instantly. It's not perfect, but it cuts down on the time of, transcribing stuff, which is a real chore, sometimes is to go back and listen to yourself, you know, for however many hours or whatever to write it all up. And just go back to Rich's, thing on styles and how would you write the different styles? I mean, sometimes it's a case of, I can be staring at like a sea of words and, you know, I'll be just going, I can't get anything out of this. I just cannot, you know, and then click, you've got that inspiration. Oh, and they rearrange themselves and I've got, it's that. That is the core of it. And then you can have, you know, you've got, I wouldn't say not for our readers really, but a kind of a flowery, or not a flowery or a purple prose, but a kind of an intro that kind of flows and a summary that all ties it all together and something like, you know, for example, John Romaine and the NHS Spitfire, you know, him flying the Spitfire with, we love the NHS, under the wings. And that to me was a really sort of, you know, I mean, John Romaine's a great guy to talk to anyway, you know, I mean, I'm blooming out, you know, but it was that sort of poignant kind of, meaning to it and the story of it and the idea of hope and hang on, this is a Spitfire that is going around the country giving hope, you know, 70, 80 years on from the Battle of Britain again, you know, that suddenly wow, that's the angle.
Yeah, yeah. And take
Otter actually here as well. I use that one. It doesn't necessarily pick up all the aviation nuances and stuff, but it's the gets the heavy lifting done, doesn't it?
You've got
something to work with, and it's easy then to sort of cut and paste and chop the interview around once you've got that all down in one. So yeah, another one for Otter here.
And when you're getting to that point where you've got your content, you might have some visuals, you're almost there. The one thing, and again, we perpetually struggle with this on Extended, is what you're going to title it. What's going to be that snappy link that's going to get everybody attracted to that? How does that come about for you, Steve? Where's that inspiration come from?
It comes from sitting opposite Tim and having a pun off, normally. The best pun that we can get into the article somewhere.
I love that.
Pun down.
For example, we've got a feature in the next issue of the magazine that's just gone to print. It's just hit people's doormats today. On cybersecurity. And we've called it cyber rattling. So it's trying to get the pun in that way. I think you've got to have something which drags the reader in. You've also got that stand first or the slug at the front as well, which really needs to grab somebody. And as Tim said, you've got your opening paragraph, which sets the scene for what you're doing, and you need a good summary at the end. But going back to what Rich said about knowing your readership, I think, again, the writing style varies depending on what your target audience is. And I've been lucky to write for various different magazines over the years. So I once worked with a publisher who said to me, make the reader know you and like you. And that way you'll get a lot of loyalty from your readers. You know, they may pick up the magazine, not particularly be interested in what's on the front cover, but they're loyal to you as an editor and an author, and they want to read what you have to say. And that's very different to what we do with Aerospace. We don't generally put a personality into the features. So I think if you were in a situation where you're submitting articles to magazines, it's something to be wary of, is that just what target audience does that magazine have, and how do they want that feature pitch?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, then developing that thinking on a bit further, one of the things that you talked about there was a front cover. And in this world, again, of short attention spans, it would appear. Rich, let me come to you for this. How's the new media formats changed the way we write and present our stories?
Yeah, I think it has. I say that with a little bit of doubt, because I think there's still a real market and a need for that in-depth kind of like holding a magazine and sitting down and getting lost in 3,500 words of something you absolutely love. I don't think you can really replace that. I think you kind of have to be quite mindful and deliberate to carve out time to sit down and do that as a consumer, right? You know, we all would sit and flick on our phones, and yeah, it's just like 2 second attention span or whatever it is to grab people's attention. But there is still something that you, if you do that too much, I think you kind of like something still within me, at least, again, talking from my point of view, that misses the kind of like, oh, I just want to sit and read something, you know. And sometimes that is a blog entry on my phone that might be, 5-10 minutes or so, or it might be, you know, a stack of the magazines there and the books over there, or the books along Stephen's book, very impressive bookshelf behind him at the moment. You know, and that's fantastic, isn't it? And, you know, we'd all be an advocate for the pastime of or work of sitting down and actually reading and researching from a physical product in our hands. So I don't think that'll ever change. I hope it doesn't. But certainly in terms of what we do as, you know, in our jobs and our roles, in that you've got to be quite mindful again who you're writing for. So, you know, obviously, like say a magazine like Combat Aircraft has got, the full blown magazine articles, say 3,500 words, whatever. They might have a 500 or 800 word in depth news piece at the front of the mag, and they might have a couple of paragraphs in the news section, or they might have a couple of lines as a caption to an image. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of like where does that story fit in those sections, and what does the editor want, of course, as well. So that's important from that side of things. And obviously anything on the internet is shorter and more punchy and, you know, has to grab the headlines without then being too clickbaity as well. Cause that just, I don't know anyone that enjoys that. Oh, you know, that sounds like an interesting heading. Ha ha, they've got me. That was fun. You know, I don't think there's anyone out there now that enjoys that. And in fact, I think it's gone the opposite, that if you're trying to be too clickbaity, it gets too annoying. So, you know, it's kind of like keeping up with a little bit of the trends there, what is working and what isn't. But the bottom line is you've got to get the traffic in as well, right? So, you know, a good image, with a good few lines to start with, well placed in a social media advert or tweet, is incredibly powerful, because the way that can then get picked up and go viral, you can't do that with a mag. You can't just send out another 50,000 magazines to people because they're interested in it, you know, whereas a tweet, you can get 50,000 people reading that.
Yeah.
I don't know what the formula is to do that, but it, you know, when it happens, it happens, right?
That's
invaluable.
Yeah. And that leads people into the product, but then you have to deliver the quality product at the end of the day. I think that's where the magazine sits now in the magazine industry in general. A magazine is a luxury product now. You know, let's face it, it's not a cheap product. You know, you go into the news agents now to buy an aeroplane magazine, it's not a cheap thing. But I think we as editors, journalists, have a responsibility to deliver a quality product. But we're also in a situation where we can, with the network of contact that we've got, we can offer that in-depth that perhaps you won't get from reading somebody's blog. I mean, everybody can be a journalist now. You know, we could post an online magazine from our back bedroom. Everybody's a journalist. But so our job is more difficult now in that we need to actually elevate what we do to make somebody really, really want to read what we have.
Yeah.
And as Tim said there about the NHS Spitfire feature, you know, we're in a privileged situation. We can go and knock on John Romaine's door, talk to John, have a look in the hangar, and put the reader somewhere that they can't get. Yeah. And I think a magazine comes into its own, we can give that in-depth coverage and quality coverage.
That's a good point there on the bloggers and everyone being a journalist. That's changed the industry. I mean, I've been to things. So I was out with Airbus last week, and they had obviously the world's media there, about 100 of the, you know, aviation media and influencers. So there was people there who were, you know, designated influencers, who, you know, some of them know their stuff. Some of them really do know the nuts and bolts. And some of them are just what I'd probably call kind of travel bloggers, or maybe people. So these are the people who got into blogging, got into, you know, kind of this sort of it's not aviation journalism, but it's kind of travel blogging, travel influencing. It's basically, comfy seats on aeroplanes, and I'm in first class, and this aeroplane is, you know, this airline has given me a free flight to X, you know, isn't it great? And you know, all right, fair enough, that there's a market for that, and they are, you know, people like seeing nice pictures of people on their holidays, or people on, you know, seats and the comforts you'll get, and what does the IFE look like? But the thing I think we have to be a little bit careful is when they start bleeding over onto serious aviation journalism and start talking about things like sort of safety and crashes and accidents and, or, you know, military aviation or what's happening in Ukraine and stuff like that. And it's kind of, okay, you're out of your comfort zone here, and you're talking about things that maybe your knowledge isn't as good as, you know?
Yeah. Good point.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
I want to come back to you, though, Steve. You made a point there about magazines, and I want to just explore that a little bit. Because we saw a bit of a resurgence in, we'll keep to our sector, in aviation, in the aviation book world, the printed book world. You know, maybe it was locked down, who knows. But we've seen a bit of a resurgent in books. And, you know, books aren't cheap either, but unless you use Amazon, of course. Some, you know, a paperback book is £7, you know, £7.99 on Amazon. A magazine's a similar price. Are those two formats competing in any way? I know sometimes the topics are very different, but certainly for me, and you know, in my life, if my wife's in WH Smith and she sees a magazine or she sees a book, she's sort of like got a bit of a conflict there.
Well, because it's
exactly where I was going, Tim. Exactly where I was going. You've got the third category. You've got the bookazine, which is the looks like a magazine, but it's got a spine like a book.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of these out, particularly during lockdown. And I've done quite a few for different publishers over the years. We've done ones on the Vietnam War. We've done ones on Aircrew, had the VC. So I think that is really blurring the lines. So I think a bookazine is in competition with a book. I think a magazine, not so much, because a magazine has much broader content. You know, you wouldn't have a magazine all on this, on one subject. But we found that, yeah, the bookazine market has been particularly buoyant. And I think that's the reason that you see quite a lot in, you know, on the shelves in WH Smith at the moment on whatever anniversary it happens to be. And you mentioned earlier about choosing subjects. I'm a big believer in trying to hang your hat on an anniversary, really. I mean, yeah, I'm writing a blog at the moment for the Society website, which is about Bert Rutan. So, you know, Bert Rutan had these wonderful, you know, weird and wacky designs, and it's 50 years this year. So that's great. You know, 50th anniversary, that gives us an opportunity to talk about something which is perhaps not newsworthy, as in it's not topical in terms of there's a new product to talk about, but it's still an interesting story. You mentioned books. I went to the Telford, the IPMS bottle show at Telford, and the amount of books that were being launched there from all sorts of publishers, from, you know, Pen and Sword and Casemate through to Hellion and Harpier and all sorts of, that, I don't think that we've been in a situation for many years where there've been this amount of books come out on very, very eclectic subjects. You look at some of the stuff that Tom Cooper's doing, and, you know, what is it, Algerian War in 1952 to 53, or whatever it happens to be. So there has to be a market. You know, these people wouldn't publish these books if they weren't selling. So I guess answering your question, Peter, I think there is the market for everybody, because everybody still seems to be selling a product at the moment. Nobody seems to be treading on each other's toes.
Yeah, okay. Right, time to put you all on the spot a little bit more then. Rich, I'll come to you first. Is there a journalist, a photographer out there you particularly like, that you really enjoy reading? Is there a publication that you really look at and say, do you know what, that's a really good piece of work?
Yeah, so it's probably easier to reply on the photography side. There's a guy at the moment who's come across from the motorsport industry and loves his aeroplanes. It's a guy called Camden Thrasher. I had the pleasure to meet him recently as well, actually, over in the States, and did a shoot with him. But he's really developed his own style. It's incredible. It's quite inspiring, actually, to see how he approaches aviation and, you know, brings some of the motorsport skills, you know, in terms of, like, portraying movement and speed and colour and light into photography, because I think sometimes, you know, we're all guilty of it, and we're kind of like focusing on these beautiful aeroplanes, and we geek out a little bit, and it's a picture of an aeroplane rather than the art and the passion behind it. So it's something I try to do and sometimes may succeed, but he's grown very quickly, and I really enjoy his stuff. So he would definitely be one at the moment. As list as long as your arm, there's no doubt about it. From writing point of view, I'm going to say Joe Kopperman. He's a friend of mine anyway, but that's irrelevant. Yep. His work is outstanding. His research into stuff that has never been researched, and his ability to convey a story that's never been told, or a story that's regularly told and tell it in a new way, is exemplary. Yep. It's entertaining, yep. and it's factual. And if you can get a blend of being entertaining and factual in our industry, then that's gold. You know, he's excellent.
Yeah, good guy. Good guy, Joe. Good guy. Tim, let me come to you then. How about you?
Gosh. Right. Okay. Who do I? I think you'd have to, any discussion of aviation, journalism, people like, Guy Norris, Aviation Week. Greg Warwick, also Aviation Week. Dominic Gates in the US. I mean, he's done amazing work on scoops and being really inside what's been happening at Boeing. Just really
shout.
But also, so he's not a journalist as such, but Richard Abuliafa. So he's an analyst. But he's got razor sharp wit and knowledge. He's regularly quoted. He also writes for things as well. But his ability to absolutely dissect the global aviation industry and make you laugh at the same time.
he's got a real style.
His newsletters are just brilliant, and they are all, you know, all of them, you know, pretty much sort of spot on, you know. That's me.
Okay, well, let me shift the topic a little bit and talk about how you get some of these articles. Steve, you wanted me to ask you that question too, didn't you? All right, come on then, let's hear yours.
Well, I'm a big fan of Tim Robinson. I think he's a very good writer. apart from that, I'm going to throw a name in the hat for one of the people I'm really tipping for the future as an up-and-coming author, and that's Elliot Marsh. Elliot produces the Vintage Aviation Echo, and last year he did a real seminal piece on Mark Hanna, you know, a five-part series, I think it was, on the life of Mark Hanna. Speaking to so many people, got so many in-depth interviews with people who knew Mark, flew with Mark. And I think Elliot really needs credit for that, because that was such, I mean, the amount of people that I know within the airshow industry who've just said to me, they cried while they were reading the feature, because there was so much empathy there. So I think we've got to remember that, you know, none of us are getting any younger in this industry. And it's nice to see people like Elliot, Jamie Ewan, Paul Fidian, people like that coming through as a new generation as well. So, but yeah, big fan of Elliot's.
Okay, yeah, that's a good shout. Yeah, good shout. Let me talk then about the life of being a journalist. And by the way, I use the term journalist quite generally, so it's just easy for me to use that term. Now, I could go onto my social media feeds and be very jealous of you three traveling the world. Sitting in palatial offices of companies like Airbus and Boeing and being in Area 51 and all these wonderful things. But the truth is slightly different. Just through my own experience, but, you know, working with Tim in particular, you know, tell us a little bit about some of the pressures in the job, you know, travel, being away, dodgy people you've got to work with who are a bit challenging. You know, we've all had the guest who we get on to talk and doesn't talk or doesn't give us anything. So, so Rich, let me start with you, okay. Because Co-op is an international product. It's an international brand. What sort of challenges do you have? You know, what sort of a life, is it being a journalist sometimes?
Well, one of the hardest things I find is working on a future trip when you're already on a trip. So you're out and the Wi-Fi is generally terrible and they're, you know, my phone's playing up or something. Yeah, there'll be a connectivity issue, absolutely guaranteed. And I've got, you know, say 50, 100 people booking on the next event that I'm doing whilst I'm in the middle of the desert somewhere. And like, yeah, your heart bleeds, right? But, you know, this is... It's my job to make sure that people are happy and get the best photograph they've ever taken. So if something's happening and I'm unable to make that a smooth process, then I'll find that really frustrating. You know, you could call me a perfectionist on that if you like, but I do really, really value our service to the photographers that book with us. So not being around enough to support that, because I'm already on another shoot with photographers that need my time and energy and organization and everything else is tough. And that's definitely pretty tough, especially like, so the year before COVID, I think I was away 32 weeks, something like that, maybe 34 weeks of the year. So that's obviously not as quite as crazy as that now. Things have changed a little bit. But time and time management is probably the biggest challenge of all of that. Because I'm organizing trips and when you've been out on a shoot, and I'm, you know, I've got, say, 10 people with me somewhere, and you get back to the hotel, you go out and eat together and debrief and everything else. And then you go back to the hotel and you're absolutely exhausted on some ridiculous time zone, and you've still got to deliver the images from that day to the people that hosted you, because that's what they expect now. You know, the days of, you know, I'll send you the images when the magazine's printed in a couple of months, that doesn't happen. It's now. So, you know, you've got to get some results from, you know, pretty much as soon as you get back to the hotel, before you even go out anywhere, and you're still drenched in sweat and whatever else, and oil and tarmac and everything, or dust or desert, whatever. Then you got to get some food in you. Then you've got to come back and you still got to do 4 or 5 hours work, and then get up at 4 in the morning the next day to do the same. Whilst then you've got another shoot to plan the following week or the following days ahead, you know, so that's really tough. And that's all obviously on the back of actually getting these shoots approved in the first place, which is getting harder and harder, you know, so the authorization process is laborious. It's very tough. And you could call ourselves, so buzzword at the moment would be like the SMEs, isn't it? Subject matter experts, what we are. But at the same time, whilst we can go into a squadron or an organization and say, look, you know, this is what we do, this is how we do it, they've also paid money and trained up their own photographers that might have only been there 6 months, and they have to give them those opportunities, which I totally understand. So I try and work both. I try and work with those new photographers in my shoot to make the best of all of that. So getting that through the chain of command and up and down again is quite tough. And then exactly as we said earlier, you know, editing the stuff down when you've done it, you know, photography wise and word wise, that's always a challenge, you know, getting the message succinct and getting, cause a magazine might only use like in an full article might only use like 10 shots. Whereas I've just come back from the States and like shot 10,000 shots, you know, so that's just one article, but you know what I mean? The process is really tough. I also find that, you know, nowadays everything is so, risk adverse. You know, so if I'm proposing something and, it's a little bit different to what they do, or, it's an idea that hasn't been done before, then it's just easier to say no. You know, we live in a very risk adverse world. So that's hard, you know, to get.
And you do a lot of air to air as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You do a lot of air to air.
For sure. Yeah. We do a lot of that. And that is, you know, that is a lot at stake at that as well. There's a lot of people's time and effort you know, and money involved in that, you know, from the subject point of view, from the photographer's point of view, from the aircraft's point of view, from the fuel, the tax, the landing fees, the aircraft maintenance, you know, it's thousands of pounds and dollars, whatever, euros.
Yeah.
And that's all at stake. We've got to deliver those results and get it right in a perfectly safe environment as well. And then after all of that, at the end of it, you get paid enough to get a beer when you get home, because there's not yeah. enough money in you know, aviation journalism to make a, you know, as a freelancer to make a living out of it. You've got to diversify. So yeah. diversification is absolutely vital in all of that. And, which is
fascinating. A
tough thing to do, especially with no time.
No. Tim, tell me about some of the challenges you face then.
Well, deadlines. Don't become an aviation journalist if your deadlines scare you. They're always the stuff that comes around every month. But I think one of the things we now is, and we've talked about this before, you know, social media. It's 24/7. It's always on. It's a beast that must be fed. You know, we do two blogs a week. And, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, right, okay, we've got to do this, you know. So you end up with and especially also when people are commenting on your work, you know. So, you know, you could have your notifications ping off in the middle of the night and, oh, okay, what the heck? Oh, yeah, I found an error in your blog. Right. So it's having that discipline to sort of switch off. Long nights, long days, long nights, Farnborough, Paris Air Show, you know, we were out at, the Farnborough Air Show this year, breaking all sorts of HR rules about, you know, how many hours we were about to allowed to work, you know, non-stop, because that's what you're going to do. You know, you go out there, you get up at the crack of dawn, you get to the show, you start work on it, come back, and then you've got to write it up because, you know, we're doing the daily blog. Daily blog is great. It's allowed us to punch above our weight. People like to see it. People like to see all the photos you're taking, who you're talking to.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And in the old days, what used to happen is we used to go there, and it'd be, you know, much more relaxed. It'd be a beer, a nice cheeky beer on the South Bank in Paris. And you'd have a chat and a bit of a relax. And now social media is just on all the time. So, that is one of the sort of challenges. What else? PR pitches, you know, things pinging through there and taking your time with daft PR pitches that you have to kind of wade through and people trying to, sort of like, oh, I'm a blogger in from the US and I'd like to write for your blog. Right. Okay. Do you know anything about airplanes? No. Random pitches or pushy PR people, as I say, as another people are. So, PR flacks or hacks, you know, PR flacks are sort of like, you know, ringing up and kind of pestering you for sort of like stuff, you know, usually at the most inconvenient time.
Yeah, yeah. And Stephen, we talked a lot about travel. I know you're out in the States this year and you've done a few other trips. When you talked earlier about some of the stuff you'd done before in things like Pilot Magazine and that sort of thing, it's all about being there. How much do you have to now do to be there versus sit behind one of these machines and just research and write an article?
You could research and write an article very, very easily from behind a computer, but you don't get the personal touch doing that. And talks about the owning and operating series that I used to write. That's about going out, talking to people. And that has a knock-on effect because then you build your network from doing that. You may meet somebody else on the same visit to the airfield that then says, well, actually, if you're interested in that, why don't you come and talk to me about this aeroplane that I've got or this new engine or whatever it happens to be. But going back to your question about bugbears and things in the industry, the thing I find a lot of contributors struggle with, and it's a horrible phrase, but is the ability to say something is good enough. Because you know, Tim and I and Rich, we worked a very close deadline. You know, it comes around every 3, 4, 5 weeks, we've got another magazine going to print. So when we have a contributor and we say, you know, we need the copy from you on data X. We need it on data X because that's it slots into the system that we have. And you might be writing a feature, you've got 3,000 words, and we've already talked about cutting the word count down, but also those words are important. And when do you draw the line to say, actually, I've spent 12 hours on this. This is as good as I'm going to make it within the ability that I've got. And when you're in a situation where you're editing a magazine, you could have one absolutely perfect article every month, and then you'd have 57 pages of blank paper. You have to learn that ability to say, you know, obviously we want the product to be perfect and we do the best that we can, but you also have to have that balance to say it's as good as it's going to get. And on with Tim's comments on PR people, we also have issues from time to time where PR people want to proof an article and make what we would perhaps consider unnecessary changes. No issue with changing things which are factually wrong, but writing styles or things like that, that can be, and invariably, again, you say, well, you could have a look at the article, but we go to print on Wednesday, so I need everything back by Friday, previous Friday. And invariably on Wednesday morning, they'll come through with, can we change this and can we do that? And actually that picture, can we just move that? And that is probably, I think Tim will agree, one of our biggest bugbears, in that takes a huge amount of time. And yeah, we have to just not necessarily argue our corner, but to explain why we've done something the way we've done it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's move on then. The world of funny and the world of weird. Have you got favourite places, favourite stories, weird stories from the work you do? I mean, you're often in some very unusual places, I do have to say. Anyone got any good journalistic stories?
Drinking horses' milk in Kazakhstan?
Say that again, Tim.
I give up. I can't compete with that.
this was a press trip to Kazakhstan to go and see Air Astana, and very good they were, very top carrier. But it was just bizarre in that it was Kazakhstan, somewhere I've never been before, probably never be again. And one of the things was local customs and horse's milk. That's what the nomads drink. it's an acquired taste. Let's put it this way.
I remember seeing tinned horse in Kazakhstan, just on the shelves in the local corn shops and stuff.
Yeah, you can eat dobbin.
Stores. Yeah, it's just bizarre. Big into the horses out there.
Rich, where's the most unusual place that you've been asked to take some photos?
North Korea.
Wow.
That was epic. It's one of the best things I've ever done in my life. No lies. It was incredible, and I still struggle now to put words around it, really. Just an incredible place that you go there with questions, but you leave with more questions. You know, you just can't get your head around it. So this was Wonsan in 2016, and they'd put up an air show, and it was billed as an international friendship festival, and no one really knew what to expect. There was a lot of big promises made over the first appearance of the North Korean Air Force, that we're going to get the ability to have, you know, pleasure flights in the old Soviet built airliners. They've got IL-18s and T-134s, IL-76s for staff, as well as MiG-29s, SU-25s. MiG-21s in the flying display, and obviously you're just like, what, really? But they pulled it off. It was incredible. It was with a London based team as well. They managed to pull it off with, and it was truly remarkable. It was actually a very good event as well. You know, they really organised it well. The flying was as good as you'd see anywhere in Europe. It was really, really good. And you know, even the sort of like the exhibition side of things, you know, who knew that North Korea had 7 different beer breweries, and, you know, I tried them all. They're all fantastic. Same with karaoke. And this is in North Korea. It's just like, what? Absolutely nuts. And, you know, I think probably my favorite story from that was, we had minders. So you get like a minder, you get allocated one per, I think it was about 10. And spoke perfect English, followed you around, made notes on what you were doing, and wrote up the notes for the day after each day's that we were photographing. And we were having a barbecue at the hotel afterwards, and I was trying to get our guide over. I spent like 3 or 4 days with him, and you know, he's a nice guy, young chap, very enthusiastic, great English. And we were told before we went, you know, you don't ask them about the leader, don't ask them about anything nuclear, don't ask them, because it was at a time when there was a lot of big red buttons being pushed, and don't ask them about leaving the country. So and your room's bugged, you know, so just be careful what you're saying. And they were really serious. They had a full briefing in China about it. And anyway, I tried to get our guide over to just sit down and relax for a minute and stop, you know, taking notes about us and, you know, being so official. And like, you know, we'd had a few beers and stuff. So anyway, I managed to get him over and he asked me what my favorite bit of the show was. And I was genuinely, you know, my answer was the two female MiG-21 pilots that flew the display, which was incredible. You know, it's a wicked display for a start. You know, MiG-21's just blatting around the sky in front of you, let alone the fact that North Korean Air Force ones. And they were flown by two women. It was just like, wow, this is, you know, this is quite a story. This is quite something. And they were paraded out in front of us beforehand because they'd met the leader and they were a bit celebrity status. And he was really pleased with that. He's really, really happy about it. And he said, oh, you know, that's really good to hear. So, do you know, we're the only Air Force in the world that lets women fly. And I'm like, oh, dude. No, you're not. I've got an answer to this. So I very politely explained to him, you know, about the how wrong it was without trying to be too, you know, finger pointy. And, yeah, and he didn't quite know how to answer. He just sort of like, you know, changed the subject a bit. And he said, do you know why we showed you that today? And I was like, well, it's cool. You know, I don't know. It's pretty neat to see. And he said, well, if our women can fly MiG-21s, then imagine what our men can do. And I'm like, oh, my days. All right. So I changed the subject then. I said, what do you know about London? And he said, yeah, it's got a big wheel in it, isn't it? And it's got, and I was like, yes, the London Eye. And like, it's got a river running through it. And I was like, yeah, this is the River Thames. And so I said, look, you know, do you want to come and see it one day? I'll take you around. And he literally froze on the spot. He sat bolt upright and he felt his jacket pocket and his phone was vibrating, picked it up, spoke a few words into there, looked completely ashen faced and said, I'm sorry, I've got to go. And I never saw him again. Because I'd asked him.
Wow.
That was it. It was gone.
Wow.
So are your aviation photos from that show, are they on the crew rooms of some, like, you know, North Korean MiG-29 squadrons and stuff? Framed in.
Let's just say the
signed and framed
aggressor community and the adverse of the US Air Force and the adversary community of the US Navy were very interested in my material.
Wow. Steve, how can you bring horse milking Kazakhstan and North Korean MiG-21 pilots?
I'm not sure I can, but I was lucky enough to go out to Romania with an organisation called AeroGP. You're probably familiar with the Red Bull Air Race, where there's a time trial. Well, AeroGP put various aeroplanes on the course at the same time, overtaking, and it never happened in the UK for some reason. I can't imagine why. But we were out in Tuzla, which was a former MiG-21 base, and we were doing some work with Channel 5, who were at the time testing the latest digital camcorders. And I was given the job of liaising with the head of the Romanian Civil Aviation Authority, or the equivalent of, because what we needed to do was fly 6 aerobatic aeroplanes in formation over the top of the town centre and down the river so that we can get the shots with the video cameras inside the aeroplanes. And the head of the Romanian Civil Aviation Authority took a big puff on his massive cigar and went, I don't see a problem with this. He said, but it's very boring. I've got a better idea. We've got a bridge. Why don't you fly under the bridge? Right. And this was so we did. We flew the 6 aerobatic aeroplanes inverted under the equivalent of the Tower Bridge in London. And it was a great experience. But I did some flying while I was out there in an aeroplane called a Harman Rocket, which is an air racing aerobatic aeroplane based on the Vans RV4, with a guy called Smokey Young, and Smokey was an ex-F-111 pilot. And we came back at sunset from going out to recce the course, which was off the coast at Constanta. And we broke into the overhead and landed. And Smokey went, "I'm really sorry I was quiet when we were in the air there." He said, "It suddenly dawned on me that I was flying over Romania. And that if the balloon had gone up, this was what I would have to have done. And I never thought that I would find myself flying over Eastern Europe in a peaceful situation." And that really struck a chord with me. But, you know, we were over a former Big 21 base, and we were all friends with each other.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, great stories there, guys. I'm conscious of time, but I just want to wrap up. I want to come to you, Rich, to talk about some of the work you've done recently, helping youngsters in particular, look at journalism, photojournalism, photography. What can you tell us about, how we can encourage, youngsters and people from outside the industry into careers in aviation journalism?
I think they need to be hands-on, stuck in. You know, I think that's really key. Certainly if I try and show my, so my kids are like, well, not really kids, at 18 and 19. You know, if I try and show them stuff that I've done and they see, then, you know, they like it because it's me and they can relate to my enthusiasm for it and stuff. But, you know, if I actually put them there and, which isn't easy, but, you know, get them into something and see something and experience it, then it hits the mark a lot more. So, you know, that hands-on stuff, the seeing, the feeling, the smelling, the stories of aviation, the experience of it, I think goes a long way than just me trying to enthuse about it. Although, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's got to start somewhere, right? But, you know, perfect example, so I did some work with the Typhoon display team this year and, you know, I was stood by the next to the Typhoon as it started up and they did all their, you know, ground checks and power checks and they taxied it out and took off and it was pouring down rain and everything else, which is, you know, kind of like, cool. Okay. That's great. And if I'd have gone home and told my son about that, it'd have been like, oh, all right, cool. Nice. Good day, Dad. You know, well done. But I actually, he was there stood next to me during that. So he, you know, he saw the pilots come out, all the kit, all the gear looking, you know, great. Met some of the air crew. They were having a bit of a joke with him. You know, then it started to rain and it was absolutely bucketing it down. So we sheltered under the wing of the Typhoon and he's never forgotten that. He told all his mates and everything. I was, you know, shouting under the wing of a Typhoon and then he stood back from it. He started up and there's this roar and this rush of a jet engine and then, you know, taxi past us and, you know, I obviously realized it was going to come around to the jetty flux was going to come towards us. So I managed to make sure we were safe and all that, but it was still kind of like, you know, this hot air and spray and stuff that you got from a taxiing Typhoon and it soaked us, you know, and that's he's never going to forget that. That's awesome. Yeah. I'm actually taking him up to Buntingthorpe, this Saturday. So he's going to see and hear and feel in his chest a lightning in a full chat. And, you know, that's going to be great. Cause if I just told him that, oh, this is, you know, it's an amazing aeroplane and it's going to start up and I'm going to be right there with it and I'm going to meet the guys that did it. It'd be like, yeah, cool. But I tell you, he's going to have his football socks blown off.
That's the way to inspire. That's the way to inspire them.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, guys, let's leave it there. Rich, while I'm with you, tell us where we can find out about COAP, and where we can find you.
Sure. So, coapwings.com is the program of photography events and travel organization that goes all over the world. And I've got a membership, which is coaponline.com, which is a community and entertainment and workshops for a monthly membership.
And any exciting plans for 2023?
Oh my days, how long have you got, dude? Incredible. I suppose off the top of my head, the one I'm looking forward to the most is Alaska. I love it. Alaska is so special. Never seen anywhere in the world like it that has aviation so intrinsically linked to life, and I love it out there. So that's probably the one that's making me most excited at the moment.
And is it full yet, Rich?
Hasn't gone on sale yet, mate.
All right, well, there you go. So, heads up, folks. There's still spaces.
Sign up to the website and you'll hear about it.
Rich, thank you very much. Steve, where can we find you online?
You'll find me at RAESSteveB on Twitter, and you'll find me at Stephen with a PH Bridgewater on Facebook.
And finally, Tim, where can we find you online?
Yeah, I'm still on Twitter. It still exists, even though that, you know, we've all been making Mastodon accounts, but I haven't really kind of gone much into it. Yeah, so RAS Tim R on Twitter and, yeah, aerosociety.com.
Okay, that's it then. If you've got a view on this round table, please share it with us on your social media accounts or email us at getinvolved@aviation-extended.co.uk. We'd love to hear your views and your feedback on what you read and what maybe some of our guests here today have written and presented in the past. If you want to support the program, we appreciate your reviews. Now, given our listener numbers, I'd say a fair few of you who regularly listen have never given us a review. I'm reaching out to you. Give us that 1 minute of your time it takes just to give us that little tick or some feedback on the show. Don't be shy. You can find me at Peter Johnson or Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find the wider extended team on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye all. See you next time.
Goodbye from Rich.
Thanks very much, Peter.
And finally, it's goodbye from Steve.
Thanks, Peter. See you soon.
And it's goodbye from me. Of course, I'm Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XCP Media.